Welcome to Resiliency Redefined. I'm your host, Robin, and I am thrilled to share with you information about resiliency, well-being, performance, education, business, parenting, and everything in between. I'm committed to joining you each week to talk about these big ideas and bring them into action, habits, tools, strategies, tactics that allow us to finally uncover what it takes to truly be well. And I'm just so excited that you're here. We are on a roll. Okay, so as we chatted about in the previous episodes, my work on everyday resiliency looks at these like pillars, that things that we were able to discover, I was able to discover that contributed to people being able to show up in every facet of their life, every season of their lives, especially in the most difficult ones. So there were five pillars altogether. Today, we're going to jump into pillar number four, the pillar of hope, which I think is what the world needs such a big dose of right now. Now, the reality is the world is very unwell. This isn't new. If we look from like an evolutionary perspective, the world has been like unwell often in lots of different ways. And right now in the middle of this turning, I appreciate that there's just like so much uncertainty. There is so much, oh my goodness, just conflict. There's so much division. Right now, it just feels like, you know, if you are a tender-hearted person like myself, like you're weary when you hear the news. And just the fact that it sounds as if like the dark side is winning. You know, often when I think about these feelings of just like the massiveness of all of this negativity and noise, and like, it's true. Like, it's not like we're just imagining it. It's really bad for some people. It is absolutely the worst seasons of their lives. And I often think about like in history, how other groups would have probably felt like, you know, this is the end of the world as we know it. And what I also really hold space for is how many examples in history where people are able to overcome. People are able to have, for example, the roaring 20s after the First World War, the idea that people are able to rally. And I just think that's something that's so beautiful and remarkable about the human spirit is that we find, as a collective, we find a way to persist. We find a way to move forward and to be able to do that. Again, on like a micro level, like in each in our lives on a day-to-day basis, on a community level, as a global citizen level, that one through line that I believe makes it possible. Sure, you might say, yeah, well, it's probably like this need to keep ourselves alive and that survival instinct is strong. I get that. What I see though, that like absolutely like supersedes all of this, the most permanent and the most precious through line is the principle of hope. It's choosing to live hope-filled. It's showing up, acknowledging that this is not okay. The world is not okay. Maybe you're not okay today. Maybe I'm not okay, but we trust that better days are ahead, that this isn't going to last forever, that these difficult times, these feelings of despair are not permanent. Now, in my work, especially in my first book, Calm Within the Storm, A Pathway to Everyday Resiliency, I like showed up with some like radical candor to talk about what it felt like as a 16-year-old girl who at that particular season, I actually had been institutionalized. I was in a hospital and I was there because I felt as though my pilot light went out. And what I mean by that is I believe each and every one of us, we have this little spark. We have this little spark that it keeps us holding on. And when I had my first depressive episode at 16, it literally felt like that little pilot light got extinguished. It's like it literally just got like completely taken out. And how I was able to describe it to the team that was working with me was like, I felt like my body couldn't hold hope any longer. Like I just felt like even if I would hear good news or if people would talk about like, you know, hey, we're going to get you the right treatment plan. We're going to get you back on your feet. I just like couldn't even hope anymore. I couldn't even get excited anymore. Like I just had gone and it wasn't numb, because I think even numb is a bit of a feeling. For me, when I lost hope, it was like a void. It literally, like, my body just wasn't capable of holding or feeling anything. And I'll tell you, that's a scary feeling when all of a sudden you feel this void. And I believe it was my friend Peter Katz who described it once, where he said that it's almost as if you're like, you're thirsty and there's like a glass of water on the table, but you don't even have enough like ability or energy to like get up and reach for that drink. It's like, you know that there's treatment out there. You know that there are going to be solutions to help manage and mitigate your stressors or whatever it is you're navigating, but you can't even move. It's like you're paralyzed. You're having this like paralysis of this inability to like show up. So given that I know what it feels like when the body feels void of hope, I look at this idea of being hope-filled as something that is so precious that we want to protect it. We want to ensure that there's this hedge of protection around those little pilot lights in our hearts to make sure that we are going to be okay. Now, when I dived into the research about like what hope looked like, one of the things that I was seeing was this idea for some people, it very much was a strategy. And it wasn't, let me be clear, it wasn't like toxic positivity where they're like, everything's fine, it's okay. Meanwhile, like you're living in a dumpster fire. It's not that. It was, wow, this is all not okay, yet somehow I'm still okay right now in this moment. And I know that it's going to get better. Like I know there's going to be a through line. And what I think is so beautiful is that so often that where that hope comes from, it's like, it's probably in a lot of like unexpected places. Now, one of the most pivotal moments in my life, and I've had a bunch of big TSN turning points, but one of the most critical moments for me was when I was in that hospital and I was gifted a book. I was gifted a book by a member of that kind of community. And the book was Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning. Now, to me, this is one of the most like important texts of that we could talk about and that we can share. This book was so impactful for me to understand the importance of like being able to like show up in whatever your experience is. And I read and reread and read that book over and over. It was this lifeline that I was like holding on to. Like I was white knuckling this book. And when I look back at it years later, when I was no longer in that depressive episode and I reread it, I was just like, I couldn't believe just how those words like literally helped me form perspective, acceptance, a sense of belonging, and most importantly, that through line of hope. Now, there's a line in that book that is so controversial, I would think. It says, when Viktor Frankl, he was, for folks who haven't seen that text, I can't recommend a book more than that book. This book is so important. And in the book, after he is freed from a concentration camp, he was a survivor of Auschwitz. He's freed from a concentration camp. He ends up studying the experience from the perspective of a psychiatrist because that was his training. And he developed what was called logotherapy, which is essentially purpose-filled meaning-making therapy. And one of the questions he would ask patients when they would come into them to see him for treatment. And again, this is when he was stateside at this point and he built his practice. One of the questions he would ask somebody who was clinically depressed, like somebody who was like really in the trenches of depression, he would ask them this question, like, why haven't you died yet? Like, just think about how controversial it is to ask somebody who likely is experiencing potentially suicide ideation. And here they are saying like, why haven't you? He asked them like, why are you still alive? Like if all hope is lost and you are just completely, you know, rudderless, so to speak, in life, what is it that's keeping you here? And patients would say things like, you know what? I have to feed this cat. I'm the only one who will feed this cat. The reason I'm here is that I have to feed this cat. Or other people would talk about their families or even their religious beliefs that, you know, that they can't do anything to themselves because they would, you know, don't want to go to hell. And again, that there's so many things that are wrong with that. But anyway, but I remember in his writing, he would say to that, for example, patient, he said to that patient who said, I'm showing up every day for my cats. Then he would say, then you have a will to live. That is enough. we can start from there. Like just this idea that it's just that spark. And that's very much what kind of got me thinking about hope as this strategy, this idea of a spark, and how do we cultivate it? Now, when I started to dive into this research around hope and the kind of what it was all about, what I found so challenging is so often it was kind of viewed as this kind of like Pollyanna thing, like as in it was just like, oh, it's for the weak who are able to like, you know, trust in a higher power, trust in God, universe, love, whatever it is, oneness. And there was almost as if I perceived the tone in some of the literature was very much like this was like kind of wishy-washy, right? It was like a soft skill. Yet, as somebody who was able to reignite that spark, I knew it was everything. I knew it was so much more than cognitive behavioral therapy. I knew it was so much more than even pharmaceutical intervention for me. Like this was so important for me to then be able to do the pharmaceutical, to be able to do the therapy. Like I needed that part first. So I was almost feeling a little bit jaded, like a little bit like, hey, I want hope to have a bit of a reckoning. And I remember talking about hope with lots of different people in the fields of psychology. And, you know, they kind of leaned me towards like, oh, well, you're a bit of a behaviorist, Robin, that's your training, you know, humanities training, like the humanities are the ones that are focusing. Humanistic psych is the one talking about hope, ishy, wishy-washy kind of thing. And then I remember having this opportunity where I was doing some work and I was on a military base and I was working with this group of soldiers who had just come home from a deployment. And what was so interesting in the back of my mind, like this notion of hope and kind of feeling a bit discouraged that hope was being perceived of this soft skill, you know, I just remember having these conversations outside of this military base. And then all of a sudden I show up doing some work on this military base. And there was this one group that was so remarkable. Like they had this light about them. Like they just, you know, they had served these massive deployments. So much had gone wrong. Yet there was just something about this one particular group. And there were many groups there, but this one stood out. So I remember talking with them just because I wanted to learn more. Like this was completely driven by curiosity because these people were like bright lights in a lot of darkness and a lot of heaviness. And, you know, the research suggests that 1 out of 5 members of the military, when they come home, are likely to experience post-traumatic stress. So, you know, imagine there's this cloud. If you have 300 of these people together, people are hurting, but these group were different. Okay. So I talked to them and I was like, and I finally got to the point where I'm like, I just want to know more. Like, I feel like whatever y'all doing or you're doing it right. And I want to share that with other people, help me understand. And this one soldier, and he was like gnarly. Like I remember his knuckles, they looked like they had been broken multiple times. Like he was just this beast of a man. And he said to me, he's like, oh, hey, you know, doc, this is easy. I got this for you. And of course, like I'm like on the edge of my seat while I'm standing. And he said, before I had deployed, I had started to paint my kitchen, but I only got half done. And now that I'm home, I'm just so appreciative to be able to paint the rest of my kitchen. That's what's holding me in. That's what's keeping me in the fight. Okay, I don't know about you, but I thought that was so peculiar because I just didn't see a half-finished house project being this pull that was holding him in this positive place. And then all these other people started to chime in and they told me about their half-finished house projects. Somebody had put hardwood floor down, but didn't finish all the rooms and they were going to do that. Somebody else was working on a fence. And like, they all started to tell me about these half-finished house projects. So to me, this is so peculiar because the last thing I would imagine was like, you know, all of these people using these like half projects. So I did ask their senior lieutenant respectfully later on because I was just so, I just was almost like, I could just didn't make sense of it. I needed some clarity. So I said to him, I explained to him how I had been chatting with these troops and this is what they shared with me. And this senior lieutenant, and again, he was another gnarly dude who I believe he told me like he had over, like he had double digits of tours. So this guy was seasoned. And he said to me, he said, Robin, my soldiers leave half-finished house projects as signs of hope for their families that they're coming home, that they leave evidence on the ground that there's still work to be done here too. And when they get when they're back home, when they're here, and they know they're on their way home, they're able to fulfill that. They're able to finish those projects. Now, I did ask that weathered lieutenant. I said, sir, like what happens if they don't come back? because that's a reality in the Canadian services. I'm like, what happens then? And then I remember him looking at me with just this, like, just the deepest level of like strength, but compassion. And he said, then we will show up and finish anything because an entire family serves. And as their leader, I will make sure that they are okay too. Their family's okay. We look after each other. And again, I asked that weather lieutenant next. I said, sir, you're suggesting that hope is a choice, that like people are choosing to stay in this place of being hope filled. And he said, Robin, if you want to be of service in any capacity, whatever service looks like to you, you have to find your own strategy and practice to stay hope filled. No one can do that work for you. So my gentle invitation to each and every one of you, when you think about your hope practice, it's got to be something that you create. It's something that you put into place that no matter what, you can stay in that place of being hope-filled. That no matter the noise, the negativity, all of the distractions, all of the naysayers, it doesn't matter, that you have this lifeline that come what may, you trust that you are going to find a way through, that you are well-resourced. So I go back and all of a sudden I'm, you know, looking at all of those psychology people who were kind of, I felt, were kind of painting hope as a little bit wishy-washy, especially in the realm of behaviorism. And I just still remember this, like these gnarly soldiers who I was like, okay, these guys are not soft. These are some of the strongest humans I had ever seen. And the fact that they cultivated hope practices to forge this ability to keep showing up for one another, for their family systems, for the people beside them to their left and their right. Hope became something to me that was just like that illustrated the power of hope, even in the most hardened conditions. Like even in the most hardened conditions, like people show up. So my gentle invitation again to each and every one of you is, what is your hope practice? Now, I have so many of them. Like I have gotten to the point where one of the things I often share with people close to me is I am a collector of precious moments. I collect hope stories. I collect memories. I collect music, poems, information, anything that can keep this hope practice strong. And again, I imagine it as that little tiny light. And I want to make sure each and every day I'm putting something towards that to ensure that it can burn bright, that it will not go out on me again. Now, I have had another experience where I did go through another depressive episode. And again, what I remember so accurately and like so vividly in that moment is I had so many of these seeds planted of hope that even though once again, I went through this episode where my body couldn't hold hope, I was able to cultivate it and find it so much quicker than I was the first time. And often you see the opposite, that when we've had experiences or episodes, like recurrences tend to be more difficult. Yet for me, it was the opposite because I had left all of these practices of hope all around me. Now we can talk more. And as this evolves, I'm happy to talk more about what some hope practices could look like. But I think the big takeaway is that number one, hope is a strategy. It is not woo-woo. It is science. You have to believe in your bones that better days are ahead, that you are well-resourced to figure this out. And not everything happens for a reason. We kind of talked about that earlier. What matters is what we do with the pieces and the parts. And I trust that we have this amazing capacity to show up and hold on to big, bright, bold futures. So my dear listeners, thank you for spending some time. Again, I'm always mindful of all of the podcasts you could download, listen to, click play, that you pick this one. It's not lost on me. I hope you found something helpful in these remarks. I also hope that if you just even had that little spark of just like, wow, I needed to hear that today, please, please, please pass it on to somebody else. I want to be a hope dealer. I want us to pass on hope to the people who need to hear it most, and to be able to hold that line, especially if we're feeling a bit vulnerable or just a little bit tenderhearted. And we just got to have more exposure to the positive hopes, and our receptors will pick it up. It will give us a great batch of some dopamine, some oxytocin. We're going to be able to have what we need to be able to show up, to continue to do the big, good work. So my friends, thank you for listening. I hope you can tune in next time, where we're going to dive in the fifth pillar, which just is this wild card. It's humor. And I can't wait to tell you about what we have learned about why resilient people are so funny and why their humor is so dark. Okay, resilient people are hilarious, but their humor is dark. And I'm going to help you understand. And I can't wait to share that information with you as to why is that the case. So thanks for listening. I hope you enjoy your day, and please take good care. Thanks for being here. Bye for now. Thank you for spending time with this podcast episode today. I hope you found something helpful in Resiliency Redefined. Please feel free to share it with somebody who you might think could benefit. Maybe there was something useful, something in particular that you think you could pay forward. Also, if you have a moment, please feel free to rate and review this podcast wherever you like to listen to your podcasts. It means the world to me. And again, thanks for your time. Thank you for your interest. Take good care, and I'll see you next time.